Welcome to The New Exchange, a podcast series that explores how everyone has a story to tell. My name is Kent Grepierre, and it brings me a lot of joy getting to bring you yet another guest from Ireland. This time it's with David Keenan, a singer-songwriter who could be best described as a maverick. To my luck, we've had a few mavericks on this series, but never one like David. In many ways, he's what I'd call an artist's artist, meaning that he's a creative who exists solely for the act of craft. What I love about his art is how it's not pointed towards impressing a highbrow crowd. No, it's more towards reaching as many people as possible without needing to compromise a vision. Way back in 2019, I had David on my old series, The 405 Exchange, and I still to this day remember that afternoon fondly. We had a conversation centered around the very existence of art, and this new podcast episode is very much an extension of that initial conversation. Together, we delve into art's function within a world stuck in disarray, especially in the context of a global pandemic that's pretty much changed everything. We also talk about the difficult yet liberating work that went into David's second album, and we also have a beautiful talk to remember and celebrate his friend and bandmate, Gar Kane, who sadly passed away October 2020. Last year, David released a tribute song called His Name Was Gar Kane, which is available via Bandcamp. I'll have a link in the description, do check it out, and note that all proceeds to the song go to Gar's widow and children. I should also mention that funnily enough, this was the first episode we recorded for the season way back at the top of the summer. Since then, David's gone on to create another album, which you can pre-order right now. That album is called Crude and will be out on November 11th. This is The New Exchange with David Keenan. Enjoy. Been a long time. How are you getting on today, David?
I'm doing good. I'm in Ireland. I'm in County Kilkenny. I've been living here since March.
Oh, yeah.
I was living in Spain. Living in Spain for a while before that. But I'm good. I was swimming in the river yesterday. Yeah, grateful to be alive.
Man, I hear that. And like, talk about like a beautiful thing as well. Like, was living in Spain something that happened during the pandemic or like beforehand?
Yeah, in the middle of it, we were there for most of it, me and my girlfriend. We moved to a place called Sitges outside Barcelona. And I feel like it was always meant to be. I was always drawn to Catalonia. I read a book, Homage to Catalonia, and it was by George Orwell. He wrote about his experiences in the Spanish Civil War. And I read that when I was 17, and I always wanted to go. I'd never been. And so that relationship or higher power or whatever brought me to Catalonia. We lived there. We were happy there. Yeah, it was brilliant because, I mean, at the time, there was no life at all. So it was the best thing that happened, really, in hindsight, you know?
Yeah, completely. I mean, this is kind of beautifully serendipitous because For context for the listeners, we're recording this during the summer and this talk will be out in the autumn. And I miss Ireland a lot. Like, we talked a lot years back about how Ireland's very much a second home to me. I can't wait to get back there. How have you been feeling about your home country as of late, especially after what you've experienced these last few years? I mean, to leave and to go back, it's quite a jarring thing, isn't it?
It is a jarring thing. Psychologically, yeah. There is this psychological kind of cross that you can carry about leaving Ireland and getting notions of yourself. That's what we call it, you know. He's getting notions. He's over there in Paris getting notions, or he's it's really like, I was talking to a friend of mine recently about this, and it's just the head. It's a hangover from being colonized with British, you know. And then I think if you want to even go back further, I think it's like back when we were tribal and there was predators that could attack us. So if you made too much noise, or if you made too much commotion, or if you got too big for your boots, you might be a danger to the tribe, you know?
This is a bit of an aside, but I couldn't help but wonder when you said that, because I feel like that aspect of isolation is something that I've heard many artists expound over the years. But I think something that's quite fascinating is that when you're in it, it's very much a thing where you feel like you're the only one who's experiencing it. And I wonder for you, have you ever come across an artist like through your travels and through like, you know, your peer groups that didn't share that sentiment? Meaning, have you ever met an artist that didn't in some way, shape or form isolate themselves when they were younger? Because I almost don't know if I've ever, I don't think I ever have.
I'm grateful that whatever it was, a desire or an awareness to a compulsion to create, to express myself, because it's been a lifeline, you know. It's been this constant companion, lifeline, you know, especially when I was younger, when I would isolate a lot, you know. And it's always been a great source of freedom and a place for me to vent. Yeah, it's been really therapeutic for me. And then, of course, it's brought me into certain situations and circumstances that have informed so much and people I've met. But yeah, I don't know what I would have been if I hadn't have pursued, or it hadn't pursued me. Probably a thief or something.
I severely relate to everything you just said there, and I think it's fascinating that we grew up in like different countries, different circles, and just different people, and yet we've had, you know, we've come around to having similar feelings and experiences. I like a couple weeks back, I was at like a work event, like one of those post work type of things with your coworkers, and I had a thing where like in my head, I had a very stark feeling. Is though, even though I'm in this like group scenario, I felt as though I was like operating from like a bird's eye looking in. And I remember in my head having a moment thinking like, I wonder if anyone here feels that way, or like, it's almost like, it's like you were saying, like whatever the school lesson was, where it's like, here you are to be a normal human being. I definitely missed that one too.
Nobody. Yeah, I'm sure I've met people that have been really kind of extroverted and out there, and well, I think it's a solitary thing, unless you're, you know, making music in a band, or unless you're kind of performing arts in a group, a dance troupe or something. It is something quite solitary, but that doesn't necessarily mean that's not necessarily a negative thing, you know. I know for me, I think like it came from a need to escape and a need to get some relief, you know, get some relief from life. I didn't know like it was a form of meditation. I didn't know that it was a form of kind of, you know, self-nursing. You know, I can put those words to it later. But no, I think I don't know. And it's not really conversations that I've had with other people. I remember being in groups of people when I was in my early 20s. And I just kind of always felt like I was missing. I was sick from school the day everybody else found out how to be in the world. You know, I just felt like I was out that day when everybody else figured that out. And, you know, but you don't know what other people are going through. You're only seeing what people are presenting, you know. So I've enjoyed kind of making music and writing on my own. It's only recently through bands and you know, making the last record up a mountain with Jonathan Mooney for 3 weeks that I could like kind of open up and let people in a bit, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's great that you brought that up, because that's one of the big reasons why we're talking today, because I really want to explore that with you, that journey of where you are at now. Because when I was going through this pandemic, like the lockdowns particularly, there were a lot of moments where I thought about certain people, and you were one of them, where I was curious about, with someone as you who very much doesn't just, it's not that you just put art into the world, you're one of those artists where I feel like it's very much how you eat and you breathe it out, and it's very much a part of you. And I know it's a very big question to ask, but I love to explore it. How do you feel experiencing the pandemic challenged your ideas of being an artist, specifically during those like few bouts of lockdown? Because something I always bring up to people, and like, it probably sounds quite a little trite, but it is how it felt. Like, there was a period of time where we didn't even know if we'd see our mates again or when. Like, it was a really weird time, wasn't it?
Yeah, it sure was. I mean, I just moved to Spain 3 days, and my bandmate passed away back in Ireland, and I couldn't get back to the funeral because of restrictions, and, you know, there was that grief. And I mean, before that, when it immediately happened, I was on tour touring the first album, and then immediately after that, I went back to my family home. It was just so bizarre. So I was there for a few months, and then we moved to Spain. And then that was a relief because it was a different environment. But then there was a lot of grief then when when my friend Gar passed away, and this kind of helplessness, but like a real kind of a real humbling thing, like, you know, this is real life, this is happening, you know, you're being humbled, you can't get back, you can't do anything, you're powerless. And I had to really kind of practice acceptance, you know, that that which is out of my control, you know, I can't control anything beyond my own responses to life. And I can't control other people. I can't control, you know, circumstances. But that was a real, like, education, man. It was really painful education. But you deal with it in your own way. And I think I was kind of on this trajectory for maybe 5 years, gigging. You have a couple of weeks off, you'll be back touring again, making an album, making a video, touring, scheming up, you know, creative ideas and trying to bring them into the world. And then that was kind of taken away. So I had this kind of total shift. And that's when I started writing, started kind of really heavily writing the second album, What Then? It was literally like, you know, what then? What next? Who am I? Who is the ego, you know? And obviously I wasn't on tour, so I wasn't getting that validation, you know, like you're a musician, you're on tour and you're a lot of your self-worth. I don't know anybody else, but like a lot of unhealthily, your self-worth can be wrapped up in how other people respond to you, you know, i.e. with positivity, you know, in that bubble when you're on the road and people are giving you a round of applause every fucking night, you know. So that's a drug, you know, and that's something that a lot of my self-worth was wrapped up in, you know, because I've been doing this from the age of like 16, you know, gigging every week. And when that's kind of taken away, you're kind of like, whoa, who am I? And oh no, you know, my dummy's been taken off me. Give me back my teddy bear or whatever. And also the disconnect of, I'm looking at the cynical aspect, but if you go back to the actual, the healthy stuff of just touring, meeting people, interacting, you know, you're out of your own head, you're out of yourself. So all that was taken away. But I was blessed that we were in Spain, we were right by the sea, and I started swimming. And I couldn't swim when I moved there, and I taught myself how to swim. And that was a huge deal for me. Learning to swim, I started to paint. And I was rubbish, you know, at least in my own head. I was just making a mess. But then I discovered it's not about, like, you're never going to paint a classical masterpiece or whatever. Just make a mess, because you're allowed to be a beginner. You're allowed to make mistakes, you know, and you're allowed to have fun. And then. I don't know. I got a lot out of it, to be honest. It was really deep work. And it brought me into some, you know, really sensitive areas in my own soul. And I wrote about it, you know. So that's where the second album really came from. But beyond that, there was a shift for the first time where it wasn't the be-all and end-all. And whether David was playing a gig or not, it didn't matter. He was still worthy and good enough and worthy of a decent quality of life, you know?
Yeah, respectfully, I'm definitely going to ask you a bit about Gar later on. I'm sorry for your loss about that. I know some people also knew him as well, and we'll definitely have a chance to celebrate him, because I think that's very important. But before we do that, I did want to like tack on to something you just said there. Well, everything you said, really, because, you know, if you think about music as just an element of a medium and just like the way it exists in the world, it is obviously this element of like validation and exchange, but it is also this weird sense of like music can't exist in a vacuum. Otherwise, you would never release it if you think about it. And I'm curious if another element about everything you went through, especially in regards to just like, I love what you said there about teaching yourself how to swim. I feel like that in itself is symbolic of so many things. I wonder if going through this period, you also found yourself feeling reaffirmed towards how crucial people are in the context of just a life.
Yeah, it's easy just to get wrapped up in, you know, the self and to forget like the basic things, intimacy and love and connection. And you know, like better people than me have spoke about this more eloquently. I'm not really, it's such a big thing to kind of comprehend, but If I can kind of boil it down to, if I can distill it down, it's like we only have today to exist in, and I was definitely somebody who lived, in the past, a faulty version of the past that my head was presenting me in a future that didn't exist, and so it was never really present. And it's funny, like the water is such a healer. And even just talking about it, really, the symbolism kind of is evident, like of just teaching myself how to swim. Well, there was a lot of kind of taking responsibility in that and, freedom and fun. And I was pining for my friends. There's no doubt about that. But I was kind of giddy as well of being in this new environment, because I've always soaked up new smells and sights and people and, art. And going to the galleries around Catalonia played a big part in the art direction of the album. And but it was like a coming home, really. I think you can hear it in the songs. For one reason or the other, a big part of my journey as a younger man was, to be heard, because I felt I had something to say. But sure, don't we all feel like we've something worth to say? But I felt like, I think my songs were kind of byproducts of me being really vulnerable and trying to channel all my, my vulnerability, my sensitivity, my desires and my failings into songs. And I think when you do that and you share in an honest way, people will identify, but having it kind of taken away made me value other things. And so now I feel more kind of rounded. But it's brilliant, like being back on the road, being back touring again, I tell you. But like the gigs that I'm doing, I'm really noticing a shift in how I am, how I am when we're setting up a gig. And I'm not walking up and down like fucking, tense and uptight, and everything has to be a certain way, and there's no joy in that, man. But we did the Olympia in 2020 when my first album was released, and it was an incredible gig. But you always look for areas where you think, and I always try to look at myself honestly. And I was so uptight during that gig, and I was so spent, before the gig. And we played the Olympia 2 years later in May, and it was just a totally different thing. It was so calm. I had so much fun, and I was just part of a group. It wasn't all about me, and that's great freedom. I want to hold on to it. I don't know what it is. It's just an awareness for today. And I think gradually I've cultivated it, and I want to hang on to it. I can appreciate it more now as well. You have something ripped away from you and you have to kind of grow up, and now I'm back doing it again with a refound kind of, wow, this is fucking brilliant. It's a great group of people, the band that I have around me. I'm doing two different projects that are running parallel, like a record that is the big band sound and exploring new sounds with a band. And then this other thing, which is just me, and it's crudeness and it's primitive, and it's me digging into an electric guitar and spewing. And it's all really exciting. And I'm just grateful,
Yeah, and it ties back to that. I love how you tied everything back to like that initial ask question about people and, rediscovering the importance of them. And it was also expounded within the context of the album, and I'd like to explore that further, because what then? It's a body of work that further expands your desire for textured sounds that have, to me, a resounding human element. I think that's something that's very potent in the art that you make. There's a humanity that tends to be conveyed, and I love how you use the word crude there, in terms of just like human emotions and thoughts are quite crude. They're not really uniform in any way. Tell me, David, when you reflect on the experience of making the album, what do you think surprises you the most?
I think what we achieved was something that it was beyond expectation. I suppose that was surprising. And I was also really fearful of being up, spending 3 weeks with anybody, 3 weeks in a studio, was a lifetime. And that was a total journey in itself. Jonathan Mooney produced the record and played it, The thing I love about Jonathan is his ability to just, you know, create these landscapes with string arrangements and ambient, you know, pulse, and it's all simmering under the surface of that record. And for me, the big difference between a beginner's guide to bravery and What Then is that, like, that emotional body within me and that sits underneath the language and the lyric is represented in What Then by the strings, you know. And I just love the landscapes that are created. And we really connected up on that mountain. Aaron Steele as well, as a percussionist drummer from New York. So the three of us were up there in the studio up a mountain where my great grandfather had sheep, you know, like 100 years ago. It was like going back home. And we made this thing. It was all really surprising. It's surprising when you sit down with a pen and a song comes out. It's surprising that you get to make noise with instruments, with other humans, and that it becomes an album. It's very surprising. It's curious rather than surprising. And so it was a very curious experience, and I hope to make a lot more curious things over the next few years, you know.
You know, it's come up a couple times in this series in reference to what you just said there, where I think what's kind of astounding about music, and it's why it's so fascinating, is that, like, people make it, people conceive of it, and people, you know, congregate together to celebrate it. But when you think about the element of, like you're saying, like putting pen to paper and like the actual act of extracting idea, there's something that's transcendent about that that isn't human, that's just unexplainable, really.
Well, you kind of get out of ego, or you get out of self, you know, like when I'm writing at a certain point, there's no David anymore, you know.
You feel that way?
Yeah. After a period of time, it's just this voice, you know, and it's coming from a deeper part. Like, you know, the mind is like the water, and you get to kind of be this deep sea diver down into the consciousness, and there's this space where, you know, below the surface level of consciousness, there's this space, and it's vast, and it's unfiltered, and you get to penetrate that in kind of the act, or with the intention of creating something. You get to transcend, yeah. And like, things come out of there that I don't want to come out, and then eventually I'm grateful for them. And then it takes years for me to comprehend then what a song is about. At the time, it's just scatty, but it's fascinating then over a period of time how this mosaic can kind of present a deeper meaning, or something that I'm trying to articulate, but I could never articulate in a conversation with you, you know?
No, exactly. You know, interestingly enough, I feel like a song that encapsulates so much of what we've been talking about for the last couple of minutes is the album opener, What Then Cried Joe Soap. And tell me, I'd really love to know from a genuine place, how did this song reveal itself to you, creatively speaking, I mean?
Well, I'm sitting in the house in Kilkenny where a lot of, you know, those ideas kind of first came to me in this writing room here. And Joe Soap came as like in the form of this bald headed being, like this androgynous being that I was seeing when I closed my eyes. And I think that was like an ego death or something, you know. It was like the shedding of a skin, or an awareness that I was changing or in flux, and I was growing into something else, or maybe it wasn't even me. Maybe I was trying to channel something. But also, it's like, it's existential in the sense of like trying to comprehend what was going on at the time. Like, you know, try to comprehend it. Like, it's like hyper surreal what happened. And, you know, to be told that you can't walk down the street, you know, like, it's difficult to process that when you're not used to that environment. You know, you're not exposed to that kind of way of living. So I think for me, at the start of the song, it's really anxiety ridden, you know. But by the end of it, there's like or sorry, not by the end of the record, the journey of that album. It's me kind of like assuringly looking for more experience and more learning. But also I think it's a bit of a like, there's a bit of defiance in that song, you know? And it's me being defined against a past version of me and going, fuck you, you know, you stay where you are. I'm out of here, you know, I'm moving forward. And I'm going to sow new seeds, you know, and you're not going to fucking, you know, keep me here in the pits with you. And I'm not going to focus on the things that you just want to stay focused on, stagnation and, you know, indecision. And I'm usually like addressing myself. There's two people in the songs. It's like, it's usually like a higher and lower self that I'm talking to, you know. I find it in my songs, like, because I've released so many songs now, you get this kind of hindsight where, you know, God comes up a lot, drink comes up a lot. And a lot of the songs are, you know, two people, seemingly two people talking to each other, like a Waiting for Godot kind of thing, or a Father Ted, or, you know, it's usually me, you know, kind of trying to counsel myself, you know. So how self-obsessed am I, you know? All my songs are about me.
But I mean, it shows the complexities of just evolving as a human being. I mean, it's interesting where it's like, you know, it's kind of, I feel like the element of people changing is not necessarily an opinion, but you talk to some people and weirdly it is. And it's kind of I feel like music, especially your music and how you're describing the lyrics, it serves as a great utility. I think about a song like Sentimental Doll. And, you know, for me personally, as someone who enjoys music, like I always love it when there's lyrics that feel like a bit of a gut punch. And in that song, there's like this lyric, loneliness, the silent killer takes and never gives back. And I mean, talk about something where almost anyone who hears that will know exactly what you're talking about, but it could have a multitude of explanations, stories, or like resonance, you know? Like, it's really astounding that music can do that.
Yeah. And for me to be brought into a headspace where I can convey that, but probably, you know, when I wrote that song, I think I was, where was I? Staying in a B&B or something. And I was angry at political tokenism, because there's a falseness to that, you know. And I was maybe angry at my own apathy or something, you know, my own lack of action. So I think I channeled that into the song. But maybe there is an intention within me to, you know, like articulate things that maybe someone needs to hear for themselves. And that's, I don't say that with any kind of arrogance or any ego. I'm just like, you know, yeah, I'm glad that I can say things like that, that somebody could latch on to. Oh, fuck, you know, I can relate to that. You know, that's the gut punch, like you say. That stopped the popcorn from going into the mouth, you know, and maybe that will, if somebody holds on to that, maybe that'll, you know, inspire a shift. Because that's what music does to me, man. That's what art does to me. It gets me out of myself. And sometimes it reminds me, you know, to focus on what I need to focus on, and not to ramble around the doldrums of the head, you know?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I get that completely. And, you know, I do have to say that a big thing that I respect about the album overall, along with your debut, because we last talked right before the debut came out. We haven't really had a chance to talk after. It's like, I feel like these two projects has been like a furthering reinforcement of your approach towards music. Like, I feel like there's a dense nature to your music in contrast to most Western pop music that gets released. But it's clear to me and anyone who listens is how true the artist to you as a person. And everything we've been talking about has been reflected in that. It's very much the humanity. And I wonder, do you feel in any way from a sonic perspective that sometimes your music is a reaction towards what exists in the world, or is it just completely separate in that regard?
I don't think I could 100% say that it's not a reaction to what's going on in the world, because you know, we're absorbing things constantly. But I know it's easier for me to like what I'm doing at the moment with this kind of crude project is not doing the expected thing. And that is like the ethos with these recordings. It's to not just pick up the guitar and, you know, hold it there and sing it like that. And there you go. And there's the song. It's to get blunt and crude and do something that makes me excited again. But it's the same with the band. I mean, I don't think my music's ever been polished. The first album was live, you know, and the second album was, you know, it's kind of feral in parts as well. I mean, to say that it's not reactionary in some ways, to say that I'm totally unique, I think. So no, I can't say that, but I'd like to think that I'm trying to carve out my own pocket of originality, whatever that means, but we're all constantly taking and regurgitating, even if we don't think we are, we are.
Well, that's interesting to hear you say, because I would say in the vein of like, as someone who's experienced your music and has lived with it, and I say this respectfully, I would say in some ways, your music is quite unconventional. Now, I almost like...
Yeah, I'd agree with you there.
You would. Okay, well, you know what's fascinating? I feel like times in which I've come across musicians that have like a tonality or a nature of their music where it feels that way, there's almost a bit of a hesitance towards owning it, but you kind of own that in a way, right?
Oh yeah, no, Jesus, I definitely think I'm unconventional. I think that, you know, people in the past might have got involved, you know, come to the gigs and they were expecting a certain thing, you know, the Irish singer songwriter and you know, that whole thing. And whereas I've always tried to, you know, imbue the live gigs with a sense of, you know, welcome to the world, and also the song. And like, how could I'd be, you know, it doesn't make any sense for me to try to be conveying what we've been talking about, which is kind of like to try to be honest and to try to be exposed, you know, all these scars and things like that. How could I do that if I was like singing to a click track? And how could I do that if I didn't want, you know, I'm just using a set of paints, and sometimes you need to just like put a knife through the canvas. Do you know what I mean? And like I'm glad, I'm proud of myself for walking that path and not veering into other places where I could have done it, especially when I was younger. You know, I think other people had me typecast, you know, and that's not who I wanted to be. And it has to stay exciting for me. I'm willing to put a torch to everything that I've done for it to stay exciting for me. Like the whole thing about the second album was, I said to John Mooney, the producer, I want to turn people off with this album. I'm willing to turn people off so I can be turned on again, you know. And that's I suppose when you're an artist, you have to be selfish like that. Otherwise you're just, I've said it before, no offense to ice cream men, but you're just an ice cream man handing out ice cream to people, and you're not servicing your own soul and your own truth, you know?
How startling is it that you're able to find, because I imagine the fact that you guys work together, like after you told him that, he was probably excited or like turned on from.
Yeah, of course. let's be adventurous, let's be courageous, you know, let's color outside the lines, outside the margins. I'm all about coloring outside the margins, always, you know.
Respectfully, can I ask you about Gar Kane?
Yeah, you can. Well, I mean, I've spoken about Gar, but I could just say that, you know, without going there, being respectful for his family and for his own soul, he was a brilliant, brilliant person, and we miss him. And I can't explain why, I can't really go there, but you know, it's been one of the greatest kind of educators, losing Gar, losing his physical form. It's a real tragedy, of course, and it's something you just can't really comprehend. Like I was talking to Harry Hogan about this recently, he would have been closest to Gar, and it's just, it's people who have lost dear friends will understand that it puts everything into perspective, and it kind of, it's really sobering. And but the only thing I can say is that we have so many videos and recordings, and you know, the that concert film, and he's featured heavily in that. And I don't know, I think I love him more, and there's things I wish I had said to him, and but I don't dwell there anymore, and he's kind of helped me through that, and so has obviously the group of people. But there is always a hint of like, oh, I wish he was here, you know, experiencing these things. But he's free.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, respectfully, like, for anyone listening and they're curious about what we're talking about, I would say just Google it as opposed to just us bring it up. But I will say the reason I wanted to bring Gar up is because, first I'll say the selfish perspective for me, and then I'll expound in just a general life context. So it's going to sound crude at the beginning, but I promise it's not intended to. I personally find it terrifying how we as people exist on this planet and then we're gone. Now, it's something that we're taught when we're young, and obviously it's just a way of life, but it's something that I have found to be difficult in comprehension. But I do feel like a ray of light within that enterprise and that in just entire avenue of life is that there's knowledge that the people we knew will carry on our torch, and that they'll tell stories and keep our memories alive, and that we live in that sense. As you said, the physical form might be gone, but like the fact that we're talking about them now, there's a life within that. So only as much as you'd feel comfortable saying. But David, can you share with me a memory of him that means a lot to you, just to tell the world who he was?
Well, I tell you, I met Gar through Harry, and obviously we ended up making A Beginner's Guide to Bravery together, the first album, and you know, gigging for years together and becoming brothers, you know. But I was just thinking recently about him, and he would just say he would just give me advice at the right time. Like, I remember I was it was about 2016, and I was on tour with a hero of mine, Damien Dempsey, and I think I need to get a real job, you know, inverted commas, because I was just not, because I was I couldn't pay rent, and I was struggling, and there was a lot of pressure from, you know, just family, just to help out, and you know your music isn't bringing any money in. So I just remember Gar saying to me after the gig, like, and I didn't really, I'd only started to get to know him, and he was like, you can't get a real job, you know, don't you get a fucking real job, you know, this is, you need to focus on your songwriting now, and you need to focus on doing your thing, because it's important. And I don't know, that just meant more to me than anything. And I went through a period where I was, you know, in a bad place with alcohol, and Gar was there for me. I mean, he was there for me when I go off on one, and he kind of comfort me, you know, and he wouldn't judge either. So that's the kind of guy he was. He was like an older brother, and we used to call him the Rock of Gibraltar, because he was so, you know, steady on bass. But he was so intelligent. He was a working class guy from East Wall in Dublin. He was so intelligent and so funny, and so sharp. Like, his wit was the sharpest I've ever come across. But look, it's, life is a fragile thing, and we only have today. And you know, Gar's passing, it left its mark, and but these are things that you have to deal with in life, and I'm just grateful that I had him in my life. And and yeah, we talk about him all the time. We laugh about him, and we laugh with him. And his voice can be heard on A Beginner's Guide to Bravery, and his presence can be felt on that. So if anybody wants to know about him, you know, look him up and listen to his gift. You know, he played in Harry Hogan and the Brothers Kane. Harry's got some great songs. Tyrannosaur is an amazing song. So if anybody wants to listen to Gar doing his thing, listen to that music.
I truly do appreciate you doing that. I mean, I know that probably was like quite difficult, but the reason I even wanted to go here and like the gratitude I want to express in all this is because I do think it's important. Like, I know people can read about him and obviously they should, but I just felt like it was important that his memory also existed in like a format like this, a context like this. So I do really appreciate you going there with me.
No, listen, people can see David Keenan, and if you look me up, you know, it's David Keenan. And you look at the songs on Spotify, it's David Keenan, but there's other people there. And David Keenan, whoever that guy is, wouldn't be where he is without the likes of Gar Kane. And I'm forever grateful to him. And you know, it's important that he is remembered. But I don't know, I can only speak from a place of, and you think to yourself, how can I speak about my own experiences that might be of use without trying to preach, or because it's attraction rather than promotion, really, isn't it? But if you see your mates in trouble, just be kind, you know, just be kind. And I think people as well, audience members, realize that, you know, people up on the stage are humans as well. And social media can be a very strange place, and people can get invested in the avatar of social media, but it's not the real person. And I don't know, I think the whole collective experience we've gone through with COVID, it's brought people showed that humanity that you spoke about, and showed as well the effects of disconnect and fear and turmoil and on the mind, and the need to be gentle and the need to be inclusive, and the need to be compassionate to other people. Like, nobody has it made, you know, and we shouldn't be afraid to be vulnerable and to be inquisitive as well. It's how we learn. We should be allowed to make mistakes too. And I've made plenty of them, and I'm still making them. But yeah, Gar Kane was a beautiful man, and like I said, he made some great music. So check it out.
Yeah, you know, before we end here, the last time we spoke was in 2019, before your first album came out, A Beginner's Guide to Bravery. We've mentioned it a couple times. Now, obviously, having to release an album during the pandemic was far from ideal, I know, from having talked to several people. But before we go, I'd love to hear about an unexpected gift that you feel that album brought into your life.
Wow. Just the connection with that group of people, you know, like a bit of time away from it all. I'm so, so thankful. And it's given me the awareness now of slow down, you know. When I was making that album, everything had to be done yesterday. And, you know, you're on your first tours. And when I was chatting to you, I think it was like the first, or maybe the first or second trip to New York. And you just kind of have this expectancy that it's always going to be that way. But guess what? It ain't. And I'm just appreciating every gig now. And the fact that I get to do what I love to do. And you know, there was a time where I could, that's too twee, and say something more, you know, distant and be more of an enigma, man, you know. But that first album brought a lot of people into my life, and it also allowed for me to clear a lot of stuff off my chest and move on. So a lot of love for it. And yeah, not a bad start.
Not a bad start at all. David, thank you so much. This is lovely.
Thank you, brother. Pleasure chatting to you again.
Thank you so much for checking this out. Be sure to subscribe to The New Exchange via Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you stream podcasts. Until next time, thank you for listening.